Okay. As folks are getting seated, Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling A24-1364, Lisa Marie Parkos versus David Andrew Sandbeck.
Okay. Counsel, I think you're both familiar with the court and know you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument as well as 5 minutes for counsel for appellant on a rebuttal. The podium moves up and down. Feel free to adjust it. We will ask you to introduce yourselves and your client for the record. We are making an audio recording, so please make sure you do that. And counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Joseph G. Vaccaro, here for the appellant in this matter, David Andrew Sandbeck. I'd like to begin by discussing the point raised by the respondent in their brief, and that this is not some sort of constitutional challenge to either the statute or the judge's order. This is a question of whether the evidence presented at trial was sufficient to justify the issuance of an HRO. Normally, that's a pretty deferential standard. It's an abuse of discretion standard that's applied. But in situations such as this, where an HRO is issued based purely on speech, this court and many others have held that in order for an HRO to be issued based on pure speech, that speech needs to fall into one of three categories. It's fighting words, true threats, or substantial invasions of privacy. The Facebook posts at questions here fall into none of those categories. There's no sense that Mr. Sandbeck is itching for a fight with his relative. There's no threatening of her. And there's also no substantial invasions of her privacy. All that's posted is that Mr. Sandbeck has issues with the way she's handling the estate of their relative. Mr. Sandbeck is commenting on where she lives. Mr. Sandbeck is posting property records that are a matter of public interest and in the public record themselves, and simply stating his feelings about how he feels regarding his aunt and the management of their grandmother's affairs. Quite simply, there's no substantial invasion of his aunt's privacy. There's no substantial threat posed to her security. There's just nothing there that would justify the issuance of a harassment restraining order. This is all purely protected speech, and that has been laid out time and again by this court as being insufficient to justify the issuance of an HRO. I would note that the district court appears to have known this because the HRO in question prohibit Mr. Sandbeck from making social media posts regarding the respondent.
I appreciate the argument, counsel. What about the photographs that were posted by your client online where her face is obstructed? It's like they're demonic faces. I mean, why wouldn't a reasonable person construe the posting of with the eyes scratched out that to be a true threat or a threat to her safety or security?
He's not threatening to do anything there, and in the context...
But the implication of the photo, I mean, that's the point. Like, the implication of the photo, the crossing out of the eyes is dehumanizing her and potentially threatening to her safety.
I think in order to be a threat, there has to be some indication that the person intends to act on it. You know, we talk about, I will hit you. If you do this, I will hit you, et cetera, et cetera. An individual is free under the First Amendment to create an artistic depiction of another individual.
Is that an artistic depiction of her?
I think that is an artistic depiction. I think it is meant to visually represent Mr. Sandbeck's feelings towards his aunt. And we may not like it, but we oftentimes find art unsettling, you know.
What's your best authority that there's an intent element that attaches to the?
It's the statute. It's the statute that says the person has to intend to have a substantial adverse impact on the person's safety, security, or privacy. It also requires objectively unreasonable conduct. Some people draw pictures in order to express their emotions, et cetera, et cetera. Again, we're in the realm of protected speech here.
Wouldn't you agree that the So I'm reading the definition of harassment from the statute, right? It's repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures that have a substantial adverse effect. So that's one piece, or are intended to have a substantial adverse effect. And so why doesn't this fall into the first category of those that just simply have a substantial adverse effect?
Well, the respondent in this matter had blocked Mr. Sandbeck. Mr. Sandbeck was aware that she had been blocked. He was simply posting these to the people that followed him so people would gain an insight into his feelings about the situation. He didn't go out and seek to deliver these onto the respondent and to ensure that she was made aware of them.
That may be the case, but I think this is just about the existence of these repeated incidents that have this effect, regardless of whether he believed he was just expressing his feelings.
I think there again we have to quantify this with a certain level of reasonableness, right? That if someone is backing up their car and doesn't realize that someone's behind them, that person may indeed have a substantial fear for their safety, and that may very well be reasonable, but that's not harassment. Mr. Sandbeck clearly had other avenues to contact this person and to display his feelings towards her, and instead she seems to have sought out or received this information from third parties. Mr. Sandbeck, again, didn't go out of his way to make sure that she was exposed to this content.
Is it true, as the district court found, that your client copied other family members, her business, and her small town in the social media posts?
Yes, I think that did happen, but that's also, you know, Mr. Sandbeck is within his First Amendment right to create flyers and post them around town announcing his opinions of this person. He's free to write negative reviews of her business online. I mean, freedom of speech is inherently messy. We accept that freedom of speech exists, and we defend it for the kind of speech we find objectionable, we find potentially outside of the bounds of what makes us comfortable and what would be considered polite, but it is nonetheless protected. I think the Witchell case speaks to that explicitly in the context of harassment restraining orders.
But, I mean, the Witchell case, it was just between the husband and the wife relating to the visitation issues. This was going everywhere. Would that be a fair statement, Mr. Vaccaro?
I don't know that it was going everywhere, but yes, it was in a situation that was likely to be seen by third parties. I would agree with that, but I don't think that changes First Amendment analysis, because the First Amendment allows us to speak to anyone that we wish to about our family affairs, regardless of the feelings of our other family members about it. I don't have anything more for the court if there aren't any more questions for me. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll next hear from counsel for the respondent. Feel free to adjust the podium. Remember to introduce yourself, and 15 minutes are on the clock. You can begin when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, and warm greetings to you, counsel. My name is Samuel Edmonds. I represent the respondent in this case, Lisa Parkos. I'd suggest that this appeal presents a very simple application of the statutory definition of harassment. The trial court simply needed to find that there were repeated incidents. I don't think there's any dispute that there was more than one incident that happened in this case. The repeated incidents must have been intrusive or unwanted. It seemed very plain in the trial court record that these incidents were unwanted by my client. And finally, those unwanted incidents that are repeated must have a substantial adverse effect on the person. And I heard the court's recitation. I agree that it's an either or. The incidents must either have a substantial adverse effect or be intended to have a substantial adverse effect. I'd suggest that the record is sufficient to show that the appellant had that intent, but that's not a necessary finding. The court here just simply needs to find that they had a substantial adverse effect on the respondent. The last element of harassment, of course, is the adverse effect on the safety, security, and privacy of another, and I'd suggest that the record here, the facts, are more than sufficient for the trial court to make that finding. I wanted to highlight a couple quotes from the transcript. Ms. Parkos, my client, laid out her case in very short, succinct statements twice during the transcript that I think are very important. First, on page 22, she told the trial court, "Yes, these posts are on Facebook and Instagram. They referenced me. They referenced my daughter, a toddler. There were posts out there that were evil. They referenced me like burning things down, referenced me as an evil, satanic character, referenced me as a thief, referenced me slanderously, defamatory, saying I have stolen things." And then later in the transcript, when they returned on the second day of trial, my client told the court, "Your Honor, I've requested this restraining order for my personal well-being. I live in fear. I can't sleep at night. I'm afraid to go to work in my workshop alone. I'm afraid to be home alone. I live in constant fear." So even just those two quotes from the transcript demonstrate certainly that my client had a subjective strong fear, and tying it to the statute, a substantial adverse effect on her safety, security, and privacy. But I'd also suggest that her feeling that was subjective is also very objective, that any reasonable person in her circumstances would have felt those same things. I'd like to turn for a minute to counsel's argument related to the First Amendment. As I laid out in the brief, it's our position that First Amendment defense was not raised at the trial court and therefore cannot be argued here on appeal. The case law lays out a very specific test for when, very rarely, an issue could be argued here at the appellate court when it was not even mentioned at the trial court, and that test has just not been met here. The record certainly is far from sufficiently developed to even start to address those issues.
Mr. Edmonds, your esteemed colleague indicated that the photographs that I referenced earlier may have been the appellant's artistic expression. I didn't see testimony to that effect in the transcript. Was there any evidence presented reflective of the artistic expression of the appellant in this case?
Thank you for the question, and no. In reviewing the full trial transcript, there was no testimony or evidence offered on that point. Respectfully, though, I would suggest that this court need not even get into those questions because it's an issue that was not preserved for appeal. Had the appellant raised a constitutional challenge like that or tried to argue at the trial court that his acts and statements were protected under the First Amendment, that would have triggered a whole nother level of factual development of the record at the trial court. I'm speculating here, but a reasonable petitioner at the trial court at that point would have said, no, there's not First Amendment protection because these statements are clearly an invasion of privacy, clearly defamatory and libelous. And that would trigger a whole other set of factual questions that the trial court would have had to wrestle with about were the statements true or not? Were they opinion or were they fact? So there's just none of that in the record before this court to make any judgments here about whether First Amendment protections apply. So I would ask the court not even to get to those issues and find that the First Amendment claims were simply not argued at the trial court or preserved for appeal. I'll just go back to a few more facts from the record. I would point the court back to pages 14 and 15 of the transcript, and then pages 22 and 23. In the brief, I laid out this kind of bullet point list of the factual allegations. I think the demonic face pictures are definitely significant. My client could easily, or a reasonable person could easily, take those as threatening. But I think even more, the allegations of theft and embezzling or stealing the decedent's money. Those statements by themselves, I think, are harassing because they are, from the statute, you know, unwanted, and they substantially affected my client's safety, security, or privacy. So I would be happy to take any other questions from the court, but other than that, I will take a seat. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we will reset the clock for 5 minutes of rebuttal, and we'll turn to you for the next word. Thank you.
Thank you. Quite simply, there doesn't need to be a First Amendment challenge raised at the HRO, given the ample guidance at the district court level in the harassment restraining order, given the ample guidance that the district courts have, that they cannot issue these on the basis of protected speech. It's a question of sufficiency of the evidence. We're not making a constitutional challenge to the order. We're not making a constitutional challenge to the statute. We're saying that given the case law that says the court can only issue these based on speech that falls into one of these three categories, that the evidence is insufficient to justify the issuance of an HRO. In regards to the way that these claims made the respondent feel, the question before the district court is not whether the person is distressed by them. It's not whether the person feels afraid. The question is, does this conduct have the prohibited effect in the statute, and does it result from unprotected speech? Mr. Sandbeck is free to accuse his aunt of theft. He's free to say that she's a bad aunt. He's free to even say that she's a devil, and that those things can all cause her fear. They can cause her distress. They can cause her all sorts of negative emotions. But the question is, do those allegations and how they're made have a substantial impact on her safety, security, and her privacy? And just simply voicing those opinions, even to third parties, doesn't do that. He's not telling them where she lives. He's not informing them of her schedule. He's not encouraging somebody to harm her or to lay in wait for her or to engage in some sort of campaign to destroy her business. And explicitly removed from that definition in the statute is what the respondent brought up throughout the hearing and what counsel brings up now. Slander and defamation are not harassment. They're independent causes of action. The respondent is free to sue Mr. Sandbeck for slander and defamation if she wants to, but slander and defamation alone do not constitute harassment. And I think the idea that these photos with the eyes crossed out and all that stuff don't constitute an artistic depiction, well, that's what they are on their face. It's a photo. This isn't a photo of a famous person. This isn't some other piece of artwork that was simply reposted by Mr. Sandbeck. He made it to show that he feels as though his aunt is evil, that his
counsel,
aunt...
You would agree that we view the conduct to determine whether it's objectively unreasonable. Is that... You agree with that? I mean, that was kind of what you started with, that her subjective feelings about it aren't relevant.
We view both requires objectively unreasonable conduct and an objectively reasonable response. And I don't believe that it is objectively unreasonable or outside of the bounds of polite society, as our case law says, to create visual depictions of other people we don't like as satanic or as evil. If that was the case, then we'd open up the newspaper every day and we'd look at editorial cartoons, and politicians would have grounds to take out HROs against every editorial cartoonist in the country. It's just simply that our laws tolerate people to express extremely negative emotions about other people, whether in words or visually. The question becomes, are they engaging in some sort of immediate call to violence? Are they urging others? Are they saying that, is it a threat? Is the person saying, I'm going to commit an act of violence against you? Is it encouraging others to immediately engage in violence? Or is it revealing private details about a person's life that they may have entrusted to another? And just quite simply, none of that is present here. There's perhaps the airing of some things that other members of the family would have preferred to keep private and public, but there's nothing rising to the level of a safety concern or of the revelation of intimate details of the sort that people would be shocked to learn about and that would constitute a substantial invasion of privacy along the lines of revenge porn or the posting of someone's private medical information that they have cancer and they're trying to keep that private, or something along those lines. It's just simply Mr. Sandbeck commenting publicly on an ongoing dispute about an estate, not harassment. I don't have anything more for the court. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you to both counsel for the argument here today, as well as your briefing. The case is submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. And that being the final case on our oral calendar today, the court is in recess.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
All rise.